Welcome to this episode of Saintly Witnesses, where I talk to the Catholic behind the account. Today, I'm speaking with Amy, who runs the account on several social media platforms. Magnificat days. She called in all the way from Australia to be with us in the States to talk about her faith journey and also unpack a little bit about disability justice and like her own personal connection with that. So thank you for joining us across the whole world. In this platform.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. And so, like I mentioned, she runs the account Magnificat Days, and she's a really great advocate for Catholic social teaching and liberation related posts and content. It's a great follower to have. So if you don't follow her, please follow her. Let's get into the conversation. First question, always the same. Could you summarize like your faith journey or your cradle Catholic, revert or convert, and highlight some of the major points in your journey?
Yeah, so I am a convert to the Catholic faith. I was raised a Christian my whole life. I made the decision to continue following in that path when I was at the age of 7. We were what you would describe as a born again, charismatic type of church environment. It's probably the best way I could summarize it. So I had this quote unquote born again experience at the age of 7, and I was baptized when I was about 8 years old. My parents were very young when they had me. My mum was a single teenage mum when I was born, and she and my dad married when I would have been preschool age. They were very very passionate, very on fire for their faith. And it was a very interesting experience growing up, because there were a lot of positives to it. I remember how exuberant the worship was. There were things like dancing and very contemporary worship music, and there was speaking in tongues, laying of hands, people falling on the ground to be filled with Holy Spirit and to experience healings and all of that sort of thing. And yeah, so there was this real mixed bag for me, because again, there were a lot of positives. As a kid, it can be fun. It can be a lot of fun to be in an environment like that. But it was unfortunately also a very high control, high demand environment. I remember from an early age, a lot of things were very controlled. The type of media we were allowed to consume, the toys we could play with, that sort of thing, right up to just upbringing practices. Yeah, it was clear by the time I was entering primary school, which is sort of our equivalent of elementary school. It was clear that there were some red flags, and there was a lot of potential for good because of the work that that this group that I was raised in did in the community. But unfortunately, it just over time, that potential went away as more and more of these red flag issues kept cropping up. The leader who ran it was very, it was very clear that this person was very much a controlling person. And over time, that only got worse. And yeah, I realized that things were all right. And I felt very out of sorts as a result. I was raised in this environment for the first 18 years of my life. And definitely by the time I got to high school, which for us starts when we're about 13 years old, rather than 15, it was, I very much was questioning what I believed, what was going on around me, and whether or not I was really safe in this environment. There were a lot of abuses going on, emotional, spiritual, verbal, and yes, even physical. So it was a very yeah, it was a very confusing and fraught time for me. And I got to a point where I nearly walked away from my faith altogether because of this environment, because we were very much taught that this was the best that Christianity had to offer. We were the best Christians. Like it wasn't even a sort of a subtle thing at all. They very much were convinced that this group that we were in was the best thing that there was. What I had not known was that my parents were also questioning a lot of this. They had joined pretty much when the whole thing started, and they could see how bad it was getting. Because it had started out with all this hope and all this promise. It had come out of a charismatic movement that had occurred when my parents were kids. And so there was this buzz of excitement when this group had started, and for legitimate reason. Again, they'd done a lot of great work in the community. They introduced a lot of young people to the Christian faith in ways that their parents had kind of struggled. But it became clear that this was a very unhealthy, unsafe environment to be in. So, my family and I got out around the time I turned 18. By that point, I had finished my secondary education, and I got out with my parents in circumstances that were incredibly damaging and scary and volatile, and it had to take years of healing for my family to really to get through and preserve the relationship that we had, and to improve the relationship we had both as a family and our relationship individually and collectively that we had with God. It's a journey that we're all still on, and it's taking us to places that can be painful but are just incredibly, incredibly healing and validating. In all of this, I was, trying to get on with my life. I was very much in denial about how traumatized I was from being raised in such an environment. And I fell into some very awful habits. I was very much like into like partying and binge drinking and like even dabbled with weed quite a bit when I was about like 19 till my early 20s. I got into a serious relationship in my early 20s that I was convinced would end in a happily ever after, because I thought I could find my healing through my trauma through this relationship, which was very unhealthy. And when that didn't pan out, I then fell into some of those bad habits and other ones as well. But despite the unhealthy expectations I had in this serious relationship in my 20s, I did, on a positive side, start considering my future, and not just my future, like in terms of practical means, but also spiritually as well. By this point, I had taken a break away from church. I was visiting churches, but not really committing to anything. But I realized, I was heading into my mid-20s, and I was realizing that I wanted to find grounding in a community that had history. I was very much against being part of new church plants or anything like that, because I could see where good potential could go awry so easily. It can so easily develop into a cult of personality, into certain theological and practical issues are not ironed out for at least a few hundred years. When I was examining church history, that became very clear. I wanted to find somewhere where they had for intents and purposes, mostly sorted out the nuts and bolts, and but was still very much understanding of the need to make faith a continually living, tangible thing into whatever age they are in. I at no point considered the Catholic Church. I had misconceptions about it. Having a somewhat Protestant bias of Christian history, I believed that it was just out of the question. I didn't necessarily think they weren't Christian or anything like that. I just thought, no, after everything I've been through, it just came across to me as restrictive, as very staid, very I don't know quite how to put it, but like the whole idea of a pope and that just irked me. I thought, oh, it's just like what I had, but like 10 times bigger. But it was very clear that I was being drawn increasingly to liturgy, to sacrament, because this was a very physical and tangible and incarnational experience of spiritual realities that are conveyed in the Christian faith. I thought to myself, if Jesus could be God becoming man, then why aren't we incorporating more of our physical senses in this worship of a spiritual God? So I looked into things like, Anglican and even Orthodox, but my ex had made it clear that he was from a culturally Catholic background and he wanted, any potential children be baptized Catholic. And for him, that was just a cultural thing. But for me, that was a bit like, well, no, that's a very serious thing. I'll have to look into it because I really don't want to do that. So I actually read up on Catholicism in order to try and persuade against Catholicism in a way, which is always going to doom you. Word to the wise, if you don't want to convert to Catholicism, don't read Catholic sources. Because don't go in trying to prove it wrong, because that the guarantee that that's just what's going to get you in. Having the sort of generically socially progressive views that I did as well, I thought, maybe this could be incompatible. This was like mid 2010s era, so it was kind of milquetoast, BuzzFeed, feminist, pop feminist type views. I didn't really have a liberation lens on things yet, but despite the fact that that relationship was deteriorating, I realized the more I read up on the Catholic Church and what it actually taught, and the history of how a lot of church history had happened, and how much of this connection to the apostolic succession and to the importance of sacraments, and just this overarching theme of tradition being both a core thing that has this identity of community that does not change, the understandings of who God is, and just being able to lay out, the core of the Christian faith and how it retained that so well, while also being so incredibly dynamic. This misconception I had that the church was behind the times. Well, sure, yeah, there are aspects of it that were in my mind at the time, but I could also see where they were able to also evaluate what was happening in our day and age, and were able to speak into that in ways that I never thought such a quote unquote conservative organization would, especially when it came to issues of the environment. And the poor, and and the need to build healthy communities. That's not to say that I didn't have any trepidations and misgivings going in. I'm in Australia, and if anyone knows the history of the Catholic Church in the last 60 years, you'd know that Australia was one of the countries that experienced horrific cover-ups of abuse at the hands of clergy. And at the time that I was actually coming into the church, we were having a massive investigatory body looking into the Catholic Church and other churches and organizations that were taking part in this cover-up of abuse of children. And so it was a very troubling time, actually, for me to convert into the church. I had my confirmation in Easter of 2015, and this was in the thick of it. As I mentioned before, the relationship did deteriorate, and I also had my parents were having, understandably so, a lot of misgivings about me going in. Given what we went through, they understandably had suspicions about institution and that, which a lot of which I agree with. I guess, our ways we go about it, just kind of diverged. But understandably so, it was a very lonely time for me converting. I didn't know really any other practicing Catholics other than the ones that I had in my RCIA class and that. And so for my first few years as a Catholic actually were the shakiest. So many conversion stories you hear about, it's like, oh, instantaneously they found this community and they found their home. That took quite a few years for me, and I nearly completely walked away from it all in the beginning of 2020, because the early months of COVID brought about this need for the lockdowns. And I was keen to use that as a time to really deeply search, within myself about, what do I believe? Do I actually believe in all of this? Or is this just something that I was kind of going through the motions when I was at a certain point in time in my early 20s? I was now staring down the barrel of turning 30, and that was, something I had to seriously think about. And in the midst of that, we were dealing with, economists and other political talking heads, basically, essentially saying that they were willing to have the most vulnerable of our society die in order for the machine of capitalism to keep marching on. That radicalized me, in a significant way. I went from milquetoast, progressive, vaguely to politically apathetic to leftist, pretty much as a result of that. And at the same time, the one of the highest ranking former clergymen in Australia, who had been convicted of abuse charges and had been proven to have been one of the worst offenders at covering up extensive clergy abuse, he was released on appeal from the convictions. And so he was released from prison. And so many in the Catholic world celebrated this. And this broke my heart, because despite how I felt about the legality of that particular case, it was very clear that this man had unrepentantly covered up abuse. And anyone who's from Australia or who's followed what's happened in Australia very closely would know who I'm talking about. I'm not willing to say his name, but it nearly broke me completely. And I hit this point where I questioned God, what am I even doing here in this church? And I just felt like I had to shout into the void somewhere, because I felt very alone as a Catholic, turning around and saying that I believe that this man was guilty of covering up extensive abuse, when all these people were talking about how much of an amazing man of faith and amazing man of God that he was. It felt like I was back in this loneliness of being in this spiritually abusive environment and everyone else around me telling me that it was the best that I had. So I did, and this was around the time I got onto Twitter a lot more. And it was through that that I ended up finding a lot of the left Cath communities on there in the early months of 2020, who provided not only great emotional support when I was really openly questioning this, but showed me a different way of practicing my Catholic faith, where I didn't feel like I had to conform to a certain model of acceptable Catholic convert that was very much pushed in the Anglosphere since about the 80s, and could truly authentically be the person that I am and still be genuinely Catholic in a way, in the way that I fell in love with it in the first place. I consider that my second conversion, and I really consider that the moment that I first felt at home in the church. Since then, I've been able to connect with my diocese. I come from the Diocese of Parramatta, which is an amazing dynamic and even progressive Catholic diocese in Australia. Our bishop is a very, very humble man of God who I've, gotten to know through connecting with, the ministries that are there. We've recently had a synod as a response to Pope Francis's call for synodality, and they very much have a passion for intersectional forms of justice and seeing that play out in the Catholic Church. So I would say that, yeah, definitely. While yes, I had my confirmation in 2015, I would say that 2020 was the first time I really felt at home in the Catholic Church. I've been able to find community and find connection. And I, looking back on it all, I really do see the hand of God through all of that. Growing up, I was undiagnosed autistic, and it wasn't until I was nearly 20 that I received my diagnosis. Also, during that time, I grew up with hearing impairments due to various issues and health complications that caused permanent rupturings in my ears, which surgeries had to kind of intervene with. And a lot of that, combined with my experience of spiritual abuse and kind of having, my world sort of shaped through all of those, for a long time made me feel very distant from Christian community, made me incredibly marginalized within Christian community. And for the longest time, I felt like God was incredibly distant from me. But the last few years have really, with this intertwining, have really made me grateful to God for that, because it has developed in me a passion and an empathy for other marginalized communities that I don't think I would have had otherwise, and had I not gone through what I did. I think God has really allowed that, so that when I do feel at home with the church, as I have in the last 3 years, that I don't do that at the expense of others experiencing marginalization. So yeah, that was my journey.
Yeah, thank you for sharing a lot of powerful stuff and some traumatic instances in your faith journey. But I'm glad, through the grace of God, you were able to overcome or start to heal and recover from those periods and make sense of it all through His grace. So one thing you touched on toward the end was about your diagnosis with autism, which leads me into my next question about disability justice. So how does that connect with Catholic social teaching?
Yeah, so yeah, I am an autistic person. I'm very much use identity first language when describing that because it is such a formative part of who I am. You remove the autism, you remove so much of what has made me the person that I am. Good and bad, because the human experience is made up of both. There's this misconception that speaking about disability experiences when we advocate for ourselves and our right to exist as we are, that we're sugarcoating it. There's no sugarcoating. It's a part of the human experience with all of its complexities and messes and that sort of thing. But that should not mean that we'd be marginalized for having such an experience. Now, disability justice is essentially a look at disability through a multifaceted and intersectional lens, and an acknowledgement that we experience systems of oppression that absolutely need to be abolished and replaced. It's a slight contrast from disability rights, because disability rights is limited in scope. It's one thing to say that we should not be discriminated against in education. It's like, yeah, that's true, but we are. And merely engaging the systems that perpetuate that discrimination through things like the votes and petitions and like doing cases and that sort of thing, it's only going to go so far. Disability justice looks at the systems and goes, what do we do to overhaul that so that we don't have to keep doing voting and petitioning and legal cases and have this snail's pace of change that leaves millions of disabled people by the wayside. Disability is a very, it's a very interesting lived experience, because it is one of the it's one of the minority groups that literally every single person on earth has the potential to join. That's not something you can say for many other minority groups, because disability is something that can be both something you were born with or something you acquire. I have both types of disability. I was born autistic, and I acquired a hard of hearing lived experience. So it is interesting to see that how so many people in so much of society is about avoiding disability. It's considered this big, scary thing, but it is something that about 20%, 20 to 25% of the world has, and in varying degrees. And the experiences of disabled people who experience oppression and discrimination, which is known as ableism, which is the particular form against disabled people, can be exacerbated when they are part of other marginalized groups. A lot of people with disabilities are also members of the LGBTQIA plus community. Women with disability experience violence at the hands of family and partners and carers at rates higher than women who do not live with disability. People of color living with disability are unfortunately overrepresented in statistics regarding police violence and the like. It's a very dire situation for many of us. It's related to Catholic teaching, because Catholic teaching, of course, you have the teaching on life, the sacredness that human life has, as we are all made in the image of God. And I think a lot of Catholics will go, okay, so disabled people, are made in the image of God and are experiences of human life, and therefore we should not, harm them. And they kind of leave it at that. But unfortunately, there can be some rather paternalistic attitudes within the Catholic community regarding disability. Very often we are the subjects of charity. And this is problematic because this denies us a lot of autonomy and agency as people within our Catholic communities. Catholic social teaching also emphasizes the need for solidarity over charity. And this gets forgotten in a lot of Catholic ministries. And I think this is something that really needs to be emphasized more when we discuss disability within Catholic spaces. And I'm hoping this conversation, does turn towards that. There has been whisperings of that lately, especially as disability theology has become an ever-expanding academic pursuit. But it's not enough for it to be academic. It needs to be applied practically. So the idea with solidarity is that, the work that we do with people who are in marginalized communities is not to be speaking over them, to be doing things over them in a paternalistic, charity-based way, but to help them lead the way in order to bring about, that much needed change to remind society of the inherent dignity that we have as humans and as image bearers of God. And I think if we started focusing more on this solidarity model, I think that would go an incredibly long way to improving, the lives of people with disabilities, both inside and out of the Catholic Church.
Good answer to the last question. So you kind of highlighted a little bit about ableism and how pervasive that is in the world, and how much of a obstacle that can be toward justice and equality. As Catholics, how can we be aware and play a role in obliterating ableism?
I think for starters, engaging with disability justice collectives and organizations can really help. If you are not a Catholic who experiences disability, if you are what is considered an able-bodied or able-minded or a neurotypical Catholic, it is important that you engage with such groups because these are people who have lived experience of disability in various forms. Expanding your thinking on what entails disability also helps. A lot of people automatically think of, mobility issues, for example, or physical disabilities. But it's important to engage with the experiences of those who have things like cognitive disabilities, neurological disabilities, and the like. Looking at the different causes that are occurring in sort of a practical sense. So for example, if you're a Catholic in Canada, there is this whole thing with MAID, medical assistance in dying, that is being pushed to disability communities, like people who are living with disability, who are being coerced into taking the option to end their lives, and the supports that should be going to them, improving their quality of life due to supports and accessibility needs, are instead being pushed to ending their lives. Definitely, so that's definitely an example of a practical way, just to fight against that, to continue rally to help people who are rallying against that, donate to those sort of causes if you can't put, feet to the ground. I think as well the I think as well within Catholic beliefs, to kind of disentangle the ableist beliefs we have within ourselves and our ableist interpretations and what it means to have a relationship with God. I know that there's this, for example, there's this idea that all people with disabilities who live out the Christian faith live with this hope that our disability will just magically go away. And, you know, for some that might be their experience, but for others, we've been like, well, actually our life with disability has been one of the big things that's helped us with our relationship with God. Again, like any other human living experience, disability is complex. So obviously engage with each person as where they are at. But also, but also don't do it to entrench your own prejudices that you might not realize that you have. I mentioned, this expanding academic practice of disability theology. And there is a subsection of disability liberation theology, the idea that that as an oppressed, marginalized group, people with disability, we seek our liberation from these ableist structures, both inside and outside of the church. And there are reading materials for it. There's this one work that in particular that I particularly love. It was written by an author who unfortunately passed away. I think it was back in the late 2000s, but it's called The Disabled God. And the author is Nancy Island. She wrote this amazing collection of essays and lived experience discussions. Now, it was mostly to do with disabled bodies, that is physical disabilities. She was someone who lived with a physical disability herself. But it very much challenges the notion that to be Christian is to be free of disability, and that the eternal experience is one that's completely devoid of disability. She references Gustavo Gutierrez's theology of liberation quite extensively throughout this work, and she points to how God identifies with the disabled, much like how he does with the poor. And something that particularly stood out to me was when she talked about the glorified, resurrected body of Christ. He still bore the scars and the wounds, the open wounds that he had upon the crucifixion. There's this assumption that our glorified bodies will be free of all illness, injury, etc. And yet somehow we have this model, the very model of the resurrection, being Christ himself still living with these scars and injuries. And we look at the imageries of Jesus as, King of heaven and the universe. So in his fully realized state up in heaven, and he still bears those wounds. We worship, we worship before these images. That in and of itself should come as a challenge to Catholics, to assume that disability in and of itself is this product of original sin, like has been assumed. Now, am I saying that it's not? No. I'm just saying that we can't jump to assumptions when it comes to disability experience and living out the faith and living out our eternity in the world to come. I think there's a long way to go for a lot of Catholics in order to internalize against these prejudices and that sort of thing. But I hope at least I've given some starting off points for people then to take their own journey individually and as Catholic communities to obliterate their perceptions through ableist lenses.
Okay, I never knew there was a theology of for disability theology or disability liberation theology. It definitely sounds like something to investigate more and understand the ins and outs of. So thank you for sharing light on that. So my last question before we close is I want you to share a little bit about your own connection to this topic of disability justice. Forgive me if I'm saying it wrong, but you mentioned that you have a dual diagnosis or a dual disability. So what's your connection to this topic of disability justice?
Well, yeah, that is correct. Yeah, I live with dual disability. And for me, my personal connection with disability justice is both through is through a personal lens, is through an academic lens, and is through a theological lens. So the personal definitely was my experience as a girl growing up with what was at the time considered only the one disability, because it was obvious I had hearing issues, and that took a few years for doctors to detect. But then when it came to my more neurological side of things, it was a lot harder. My parents really had to fight for me to get some sort of answer as to what was going on. I was a child of the 90s, and at the time, there was this diagnosis, which no longer exists, but this new diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. And Asperger's syndrome is considered outdated as a term because, like, not least of all, because Hans Asperger unfortunately had connections to a certain anti-Semitic party that was in charge of Germany in the 1930s and 40s. That, yeah, unfortunately was incredibly problematic. But on top of that, it created a false separation. And as a result, the condition is now done away with as a term. It's not very accurate to what it describes with the autism spectrum. And so now it's autism spectrum disorder level one. Which the levels are not to do with functioning labels. They're more to do with the amount of support that the person requires to live in the wider community. And there are three levels of support that are determined. But at the time, it was known as Asperger's syndrome, and my family was trying to understand what was going on with me. I was not developing in the way that my peers were, even though my parents were first-time parents with me and were again both very young when I was born. They had seen, children my age and the way they behaved, and they knew automatically, yeah, something was very different with me. But they were dismissed at every turn, I was not receiving support, and this just deteriorated over time as my schooling suffered, my social connections suffered. I was bullied extensively in the grades of like 3 to 6. I was incredibly lonely to the point that I experienced trigger warning here, but I experienced very severe depression as like a 10-year-old kid, which is, looking back on it, it's just tragic. And it was interesting to see that there was, for a lot of it, there was a gender bias in diagnosis for boys versus girls. And this was especially clear when my mum first went to specialists in about the late 90s and said that she'd read up on this, this Asperger's condition. And she was saying, this sounds exactly like my daughter, but they were dismissing her. And they said, a lot of them at the time were saying that it was not something that girls could be diagnosed with. There was a medical theory at the time that it was that the only autistic condition that girls experienced was at the quote unquote severe end. So there I, you know, so that is a perfect example of the intersection of both, gender and disability discrimination, right there, because this idea that I was not functioning as I should, because the same specialist would then turn around to my mom and say, oh, but she does have this extensive issues, but no, she doesn't have a diagnostic label for it. But no, don't worry. Don't expect that she's going to meet developmental goals the same way as her peers. Don't expect her to live independently. Don't expect her to do any kind of further education. But when we're still not giving her a diagnostic label because she's not quote unquote disabled enough. So here's this clear intersection of both gender injustice and disability injustice. And that was just a taster of my personal life. And it wasn't until I was nearly 20 that I finally received my diagnosis. And the very first thing the psychologist said when we'd finished the assessments, and she said, you're a clear case of that, was, I am so sorry that it has had to take you this long. This should not have happened. And it was true. It shouldn't have. But this was the experience for so many women for decades, trying to receive any kind of support and not finding out until adulthood that we, oh my gosh, we are on the autism spectrum. There is still a gender gap in the way that disability is approached, for men and women. And this is and I have to highlight that this is true even with trans women, for example, are less likely to receive correct diagnoses and help for their disability conditions than cis men. So it's a gender gap that pervades regardless if you're a cis woman or a trans woman. Then there's in terms of my faith, a lot of what I grew up with had this idea that that if you believed in God, you'll be free of serious disease. You'll be free of disabilities and special needs. That if you pray hard enough, God will heal you of all your issues and they will all go away. So when I was quite literally on my knees every night before another hellish day at school, begging God to take away whatever it was that was going on within me, I was being told, despite all that, well, because you're still having these struggles, that means you're not believe, you are not believing enough in your heart. That nearly robbed me of a relationship with God. And that was where, theologically, as I got older and had a healthier perspective on God and faith and the church and what it means to be involved with all three, that's where I really developed that, again, that passion for disability justice within church spaces. And it's something that I continually work with within my diocese. I got to go to the pre-synod listening sessions that were happening to help form the items to put forward in the synod. And I went to about two or three of these listening sessions where I passionately advocated as a person, as an autistic person, as a dual diagnosis disabled person, for the need for our needs within parishes and dioceses and schools and other church spaces. Because I know what it is to experience marginalization on the basis of disability within faith community. And on the academic side, a lot of this was able to be articulated through my studies in university. I did get to go on to further education, much against what the specialist said was possible. And I have an associate degree in disability studies and inclusive education, which is led me into a lot of the paid work that I do now, working, working within schools and the like. So I think you find that a lot of people living with disability and who are part of disabled communities would hear this, and I know for a fact that many of them would share very similar insights that I've shared today. And so I think, as much as this is my personal connection to disability justice, it's a rather common experience as well.
Thank you for sharing your own personal connection to the topic of disability justice. I'm glad that you were able to, you make this information unique to you and advocate in the church for other people with disabilities. So that's great to hear. My last little fun question is something I always like to end the note conversations with. So in the body of Christ, we talk about the communion of saints. Who's your a favorite saint of yours, and why do you like this saint so much?
So I have a few. So Saint Faustina is my confirmation saint, and I felt a very strong connection with her because of the Divine Mercy devotion. I pray the Divine Mercy chaplet as extensively as I pray the rosary. And for someone who experienced spiritual abuse, this was a very healing thing for me. And I know there's some controversies with Saint Faustina and her visions of hell and that sort of thing. I don't focus on that so much. My focus is more on her emphasis on the mercy of God, of Christ, and how it just pours out so lavishly for the world. Again, as someone who experienced religious trauma, this has been a very healing devotion for me. The other saints that I really love, St. Oscar Romero, for his leadership and passionate advocacy for the poor and indigenous within El Salvador in a time when it was incredibly dangerous to do so with the right-wing US-backed military junta that was systematically murdering not just political advocates but clergy as well. And the fact that he martyred himself for the sake of his people, for the love of God, is something that is both inspiring and challenging to me, because that takes a lot of humility and a lot of bravery. I also feel a very strong connection with Dorothy Day, the servant of God, because there are some points of her life I do quite relate to, not just with the her being able to bring together her left-wing activism and her faith, and to be a to show that you could be a fully realized Christian and advocate for the causes that she did, and to do this this hard but humble work of direct action and mutual aid, was something that something I very much admired. But something else I could quite relate to was the fact that she was quite a messy person, in the lead up to her conversion, and in times when she questioned her faith and that sort of thing. Like, she was going into the church, she was a single mother who, to like to a child that, like, where she never married the father. In the 1920s, she would have been considered an absolute social pariah for doing so. But she never had this sense of shame about it. It was like, she went into the church for the love of her child and the love that she had for God. And she never hid the fact that, she had this rather, again, messy life before she came into the church. And it was a life that almost mirrored mine, where the God-shaped hole had been before, she filled that with liquor, with men, with any kind of validation that she could. And she never was condemning about sharing those experiences. So It very much made me feel validated in a way that it was like, I had this messy past, but I don't have to be ashamed of that. I can just acknowledge it and go, but and here is where God, sort of healed that side of me, and I don't have to hang my head low for that. Also, her ongoing frustrations with the structural church, despite her love and passion for the faith within it, very relatable, incredibly relatable to my own experience as well. So I do feel a very close affinity with Servant of God Dorothy Day. In terms of the disabled experience, there's actually a couple of other, I think, blesseds or servants of God that I very much feel very close affinity with, and I like to contrast them with suffering and joy. So a person who really I feel really gets who really gets the experience of the sense of autistic suffering that a lot of us, particularly women, have is Léonie Zélé, who is the older sister of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. She, when you read about her life, she very much exhibited so many of the symptoms of it. Like, she had low meltdowns, she was delayed in speech and walking, and she had a lot of difficulties in communication. She experienced abuse at the hands of nannies, and her own parents were very confounded with her. She wasn't like her other sisters, who were all very, docile and somewhat easy, like, quote unquote, easier for her parents. She and she wrote a lot herself, with great difficulty, because she struggled with her literacy. But she wrote, like, quite a bit about how she wished that she could have been an easier person to be, to be as a daughter, a friend, and a sister, which is absolutely heartbreaking. But she found her place. She had so many delays, and she found hope. And she ended up having an advocate in Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, because she became the first follower of Saint Thérèse's little way. And Saint Thérèse, there's quite a bit of correspondence that shows that Saint Thérèse, just felt like people were being very unfair to her sister. They were very close, and Léonie was found that her life and her relationship with God in following this little way, like, brought about so much improvement in how she felt about herself as a child of God and her place within the community. She took longer than her sisters to find her vocation, because she was knocked back from, I think, at least two convents before she found the community that she eventually stayed on with. And she spent the rest of her life, as a nun, and very much pushing for the cause of her sister's canonization when Saint Therese passed away. And it's interesting, because she ended up being one of the longest lived out of all the Zélé siblings. And so, while she experienced extensive suffering in her growing up years, she ended up becoming this person who, when she found her place, she flourished. She really, you read her life before she entered her permanent convent, before then and then after, and the difference is night and day. And it just shows how much difference a little bit of kindness can go, like, in an autistic person's life, when before all they've experienced things like criticism and abuse. Now, someone who I see more of an example of autistic joy is Servant of God Brother Juniper, who was one of St. Francis of Assisi's close followers. Now, St. Francis of Assisi is considered a bit of a model of the holy fool within Catholicism, the person who, everyone around him thinks he's completely nuts, but there's just this simple joy and love of God that carries this person their whole life, that you can't help but love and respect. And Brother Juniper went even further with that. It's very funny reading St. Francis's works whenever he discusses Brother Juniper, because Brother Juniper seems to be the only one of his followers that can confound even St. Francis of Assisi. And if you know anything about St. Francis of Assisi's life, that's saying a lot. Brother Juniper was, again, everything written about him shows a lot of signs of an autistic person. He took things very literally, especially with the rule of sharing all belongings, to the point that the friars actually banned him from having any participation with the collective items that they had, because he would literally give everything away and the friars had nothing. He was arrested quite a few times for public nudity because he would give literally all of his clothes to the poor, to the point that he had nothing to wear. And he had no issue with walking through the street naked because why wouldn't he? He just gave everything to the poor. And a lot of the stories I find very hilarious. There was that incident with the nudity meant that St. Francis asked him to never give away his items to the poor because of the amount of times he got in trouble for public nudity. So when a poor man came and begged for his cloak, he told him, "I can't give it to you, but if you violently mug me for it, I won't stop you," because there was never anything that stipulated I couldn't do that. So he let that happen, much to St. Francis's frustration. There were plenty of other stories, but I won't get into all of them because I do recommend reading up on the Little Flowers of St. Francis to find out more. But it says a lot that despite how confounding Brother Juniper could be sometimes, St. Francis once wrote, "Would it be unto God, my brothers, that we had a forest of such junipers?" Which is something that I carry with me. Would it not be that we could have a forest of such junipers? He saw Brother Juniper, despite all of these things that he considered completely bizarre and off the wall, that Juniper's love for God, love for people, and passion for doing as Christ did was seen as an example to follow, rather than something to be made a pariah for. And I think, I think that is definitely something that has given me a lot of encouragement in my own faith.
A lot of great blessings and saints that you find personal connection to and empowerment from in your own journey for disability justice and like your own personal strength. So that's really good to hear. Well, I really appreciated you coming on and sharing your real powerful faith journey as a convert to the Catholic Church, and even elaborating extensively on the importance of the intersection of disability justice and Catholic social teaching. Definitely learned some new stuff that I need to go back and research and dig deeper on, because you shed light on so much powerful stuff. But as I said in the beginning, if you don't follow the account Magnificat Days on social media, please do so and continue to be enlightened by, so that you can be enlightened by the content that she posts, that's very rooted in justice and liberation theology. But I definitely want to thank you for your time across the whole world this evening. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, for sure. And you guys can tune in to the next episode of Saintly Witnesses.